strong a signal can it receive properly? Common sense would lead you to believe that a weak signal reception is the main thing we care about. You take two handy talkies and you go to a mall and you start walking with your friend a mile apart or 2 miles apart if it's a really big mall. And the sensitivity, whether or not you're going to be able to hear your friend a mile or 2 miles away through a whole lot of terrain and trees and hills and buildings and whatever, you would think that's the most important thing. You would think as signals get stronger and stronger, particularly with an FM receiver, nothing bad would happen. Well, that's not quite the way it happens. If you're standing next to a lot of transmitters, like if you take your handy-talkie to the top of the Empire State Building, you go to the observation deck, which means you're only a couple hundred feet away from a large number of transmitters that are running very high power. Most handy-talkies, if not all handy-talkies, in that environment will just go crazy. Whenever 2, 3, 4 very, very strong signals hit the front end of the receiver at the same time, your first line of defense is, how good is the front end filtering? Well, a real good filter might have a Q of 100. That means the ratio of the bandwidth to the center frequency is roughly 100-to-1 ratio. So a receiver at 144 megacycles with a Q of 100 is going to have a bandwidth of around 1.4 megacycles. 1.4 megacycles, that's the 3 dB bandwidth. Well, if those signals are super strong, a couple of megs away, you might really care about what is the bandwidth of 20, 30, 40 dB down. So the filtering in the front end usually can defend you from very close, very strong nearby signals. The next line of defense is the IF filter. How broad is the IF filter? How steep of its skill? How steep are its skirts? Well, real good IF filters cost money. Real good front-end filters take up volume. And in the size of a small handy-talkie, unless you want to spend a whole lot of money for the IF filter and devote a whole lot of volume to the front-end filter, you can't put enough of either one of those in there. The next thing you have to worry about, and maybe it's really the second thing, is the intercept point of the mixer. A mixer, by definition, is a nonlinear stage. That's right after the first IF, correction, the first RF amplifier, right after the first front-end filter, you go into a mixer that's going to mix the signal down to the first IF. Quite often, the first IF is either 21.4 or 10.7 megacycles. That mixer, by definition, is nonlinear. That's how it does mixing. It mixes the local oscillator with the RF. The two differ by the IF frequency, and it generates an IF. So that mixer, how linear is it to the RF signals? You give a mixer very strong simultaneous RF signals on adjacent frequencies, and it generates all possible products. The second harmonic of the first signal mixing with the first harmonic of the second signal, and vice versa. Those are called third-order intermodulation distortion signals. And you look on a good spectrum analyzer as you put in two individual tones, sometimes called the two-tone test, which is something you do on a sideband transmitter, or if you're testing a complete receiver, you take two very well-tuned signal generators that are close together, put them into the receiver at the same time. You'd like to see it respond to one signal and reject the other. Well, in reality, it's going to be generating a whole Christmas tree of other products. When you see that on a spectrum analyzer, it looks like a Christmas tree. Your two main signals in the center, in the center, and then weaker and weaker signals as you go further and further out on the side, so there's a whole lot of other signals. What generates third-order intercept point is how strong is the local oscillator, how high is the dynamic range of the mixer stage, how strong is its oscillator power going into it. The bottom line of all this is that if you want a receiver that will only receive one signal in a very dense environment, the so-called dense signal environment is one of the toughest ones. If you live in a metro area, you have to devote volume to the front-end filter. You have to do a good design job to make sure the front-end filter has as high as possible Q and enough poles. You have to devote dollars to the IF filter to make sure it's got enough skirt selectivity. And you have to devote current to the stages to give them enough dynamic range, to give them enough intercept point. You've got a conflict of interest or a compromise going on when it comes to the current drain of your handy-talkie in the receive mode versus its dynamic range. A week on one charge, it's going to run for 7 days on one charge out of the battery. Well, that's going to be a tissue paper front-end radio. you design a radio so that every one of the stages can tolerate strong signals. They have to be biased to a very high point where they draw more current, and it's going to kill the battery quicker. So you got a trade-off going on here. How much battery life do you want versus how much current drain and therefore dynamic range are you willing to pay for? And how many dollars are you willing to pay for the expensive stages called RF filter and IF filter, and maybe even dollars into a high dynamic range receiver and local oscillator chain? And how much volume are you willing to devote to the radio? These modern day cell phones, which are made super small, have got some extremely exotic filters in there that are rather expensive. You and I wouldn't be able to afford them if it weren't into a very large production run. Barium tetratitanate is a material with a dielectric constant of about 100, which shrinks filters down by 10 to 1 in size. And you've got one of those kinds of filters in the front end of almost every cell phone radio. To my knowledge, no one has put barium tetratitanate type filters in the front end of handy talkies for two-way communication yet. So it's just a matter of time before they do, is one of my opinions. Also, the high dynamic range handy talkies, because they draw more current, are going to need a more and more ampere hour type battery. And so, are you willing to have a battery that's that big? Well, in the case of some of these really rugged radios, like the one you're talking about, the Sabre 3 and the HT1000 Motorola, I think these were originally designed for law enforcement purposes. And there's lots of stories of a law enforcement officer, a policeman, getting in trouble where, for whatever reason, he can't use his handgun, and he actually uses the handy talkie as a club against the perpetrator. You talk to the people who work for Motorola, periodically they get a handy talkie back, and it's got chunks of hair dug into one side of the radio, and you can ask all kinds of questions as how it got there. So you know that the radio was used as a weapon on something small. I can't think of the name of the darn thing. Saber, I think it's one of them. These super small things, in general, don't have very high dynamic range and very long battery life. So how much are you willing to pay? How much volume are you willing to tolerate? How hard are you willing to trace down a very good radio? And so what led you into buying these beautiful radios you did buy, Eugene? Somebody must have been whispering in your ear that, hey, Eugene, this is a real good radio. Buy this one. Don't worry about the price. Or I know how I can get you one at a good price. How did that happen? Have you too, EWK, K2RIW on the TechNet.
WD2HWW, comments here.
Howie.
Hey, Dick, we got a comment there. Well, I went to Hamfest and I bought a Tamiya radio, an old priest radio, and I took it to my friend's store. He programmed it for me, and I said, wow, I was amazed how well it worked, even on the ham band. I was amazed that I went up to the hill where all the repeaters are and stand right next to it, and did not get one bit of intermod. I was amazed. So I said, let me get my Saber now. The guy has a Saber, 120 channels. And I grabbed that thing so fast. I was very happy with it. And I stick it to the car, where you can stick it to the car. So, with an external microphone. And I tell you something, I wish I could take the filters out of that and stick it to my ham radio. I'd be very, very happy. Okay, we got a breaking station there. It's XW2EWK. Give it to the breaking station.
Go ahead, Howie. What's your take on how radios, handy talkies, can have high dynamic range? And I bet in your business you've seen a lot of difference between brand A and brand B of handy talkie. You got it, Howie.
Well, Dick, I use Motorola. I have Motorola gear. I have Motorola 10-meter handy talkie. I've used Sabres. I have Motorola gear on UHF. Peters are all commercial. Like the repeater on right now is a commercial receiver, commercial transmitter. Also, the oscillator, where they won't go oscillator injection, they run a cleaner oscillator. They look at it. You got to realize, a Saber brand new went for a couple of $1,000s. An HT1000, which can come in a 6-channel or a 99-channel, 16-channel, programmable radio. Usually went for around $1,000 to $1,200. You can buy those radios now on eBay for $100, $200. Those are surplus radios. And if you speak to almost any guy, most of my friends, a lot of us, all we use, I have a VX6, I'm on it right now, but most of us use commercial UHF gear. No, they give you a better front end, got better design, and they're designed for harsh environment. The Saber, I don't know if anybody knows, Motorola got sued because one of their radios was used as a weapon, and Motorola's defense was, we were told to design it that way. The military design had the Saber design with the handle. If you look at a Saber, it's got a hand grip. One of the requirements, the radio was supposed to be used in hand-to-hand combat. How do you like those apples, Dick?
My goodness, is that tough. Wow. To design a radio. I mean, you look inside of a radio, you take it apart, and you look at the very large number of components that are on multiple printed circuit boards. Sometimes they're 5, 7, and 9 layer printed circuit boards. There's a lot of delicate looking hardware in there. But sometimes it can be designed to be very tough. I mean, a radio that was made for extremely large mass production, the most reproduced transmitter receiver radio on planet Earth, arguably is the ICOM IC2AT. Something like 2 million of those have been built. I own 3 or 4 of them. One day I was up my 100-foot tower. I did something wrong. I dropped my IC2AT. It fell down 100 feet, bounced. I went down and picked it up. The battery was smashed to smithereens. PNC connector was bent off to one side. And on the outside, it looked terrible. The radio was still working. And I'm using that radio today. And that was not designed for that service. Take some of these Motorola things where they've got an extremely tough case, and somebody has done a very good mechanical engineering job of studying exactly how everything moves internally when it's subjected to a 500 G acceleration because it has just fallen some large number of feet and landed on concrete. In fact, that exact same handy talky, another time I was up a 60-foot tower and dropped it onto macadam, or what would you call it now, tar-based road, so to speak, which was under the tower. And that radio was dropped twice, survived. I've seen radios, handheld devices that are made for commercial service for one of the companies that I do consulting for. They recently came out with an advertisement where they took this handheld computing device. A man was standing on the third floor of a parking garage. He threw it over the side down to the concrete road. Then an automobile ran it over. The movie ran continuously. The man walks over, picks up this handy-talkie light device. As I said, it's a handheld. The guy then walks over to the fish pond, drops it in the bottom of the fish pond, lets it sit there for a few minutes, reaches down and picks it up, and it's still working. So if you're smart enough, if you're willing to spend the engineering, there's an amazing amount of toughness you can give to what ordinarily would look like very delicate hardware. When you see that printed circuit board all taken apart, laid on the bench, and you're told be careful about electrostatic discharge. You're supposed to make sure that your hands are properly tied down to make sure there's no static charge when you touch it. You get the impression that you're working with very elaborate, extremely small, delicate hardware. Properly assemble it, properly shock absorb it internally, and all of a sudden, it can survive 500 Gs. That's approximately what happens when you drop a radio from a third floor of a parking garage onto a concrete road and it bounces. That's about a 500 G deceleration. And in theory, you've got to test that in the X, Y, and Z plane. And I know of people who build handheld devices where their definition of one that is shippable to the customer is one where the developmental model was put into a tumbling machine, where the tumbling machine bounced it 2,000 times after it dropped 6 feet. So there are chunks of electronics these days that are being very well designed. And so Eugene has given us an example. Howie is giving us an example. And so if those properties are important to you, if you want your radio to be capable of being used as a physical weapon, as a baton or whatever, you go to the right brand name, spend enough dollars, you do enough research, there are very tough radios out there. You got to be careful of something else. Take it apart, and you do whatever you want to do to make modifications on the inside, troubleshoot or whatever. Be very careful when you put it back together. Don't leave out any of these silly-looking little brackets and whatever that look like they're not required. When it comes to the full assembly, in theory, some very smart mechanical engineer has figured out exactly how everything is going to move internally during one of these high G decelerations when the darn thing's being dropped. Don't leave out any of these silly-looking, useless parts. Don't leave any of the screws loose. If you want that full protection, leave in every single piece of rubber, every single screw, tighten it properly, use every single bracket, leave nothing out. And if when you put it all back together, if you're lacking one or two of the screws on the outside that hold the case together, you better treat that radio with tender, loving care until you, by some means, find those missing screws. All that integrity is designed in the radio when everything is there, properly tightened. Don't leave anything out. You're going to be compromising the strength of that radio, and the next time you drop it off your belt and it goes falling down to the road. On a couple of occasions, my handy talkies, because I've done some dumb things in my life, I'm packing things into my automobile, and the handy talkie is in my hand and it's in the way, and I put it on top of my automobile temporarily. On at least two occasions, I go driving away, and I hear a funny clunk-clunk sound on the road, and I say, oh no, I did it again. My handy talkie was on the roof of the road, I went driving down the street, and it fell off the roof and went clunking onto the road. Lucky for me, on the two occasions I've done that, my radio has survived. But it's a really dumb thing to do. Think about that. When you're super busy loading things into your car, you better not even temporarily lay something on the roof like I've done, because there's a small chance you're going to forget it. Anybody got any comments, any war stories about the toughness of their radios? Please give us your call letters right now. KQRIW on the TechNet.
That means it's KEY.
I hear KEY. And I think I hear Eugene. Mel first, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's not unusual for certain pieces of equipment to be made what you would call tough. For instance, Fluke makes a number of their handy VOMs, or I should say the 10-digital VOM version, that are fairly tough because you go out into industry and you see a number of test instruments. AEA makes an instrument for the telephone company, for the guys to use up on the poles for checking for short and resistance loads and everything that also can survive quite a bit. So don't say that ICOM or Yaesu, they have their military version of a number of pieces of their equipment. But like you say, if you want to look at some of their mil-spec stuff, oh boy, you're going to pay through the nose. Like you say, like the Motorola, I have also one of Motorola. That thing is a weapon. You code it around for a while, you know what you got there. But like I say, if you want to buy, if you want to spend the money, you can get good equipment in almost every type of line, whether it be test equipment or communications. It's just that you don't mind the weight, the battery drain, and the cost. There's no problem there, Dick, but I have a number of things that I find that amazing, the abuse that they can take. Go ahead.
WB2HWW. Dick, just so you know, this Motorola was held blameless. The court, Motorola basically turned around and said, you can't sue us, you got to sue the military or the police, because the Sabre, the specifications were, it had to have a grip, and it had to be designed that way.
Makes sense. So, yeah, they would have been the victim if they were ordered to make it tough enough to be used as a weapon, and then somebody in turn sued them because it was used as a weapon. It's almost as silly as suing a gun company or a company who makes ammunition because the ammunition was used to kill somebody. It's not the ammunition that killed somebody. It's the man who loaded it in the gun, who pointed it at a human being, and pulled the trigger. So, every automobile is capable of killing somebody if you misuse that automobile. Are we going to sue automobile manufacturers because they're capable of killing pedestrians if you hit them with the automobile? Of course that's silly. You have to make sure you've got qualified drivers who drive in a way that they don't hit pedestrians, and so on. So lot of frivolous, silly, and crazy lawsuits going around from time to time. I think Eugene possibly had another comment. Good question you asked, Eugene. Back to you, Eugene.
Okay, Dick. Another thing, in Patchogue, this guy was telling me about this cop had the radio, and this guy ran for his pistol, you know, to get the cop's gun out of his holster, and the cop took the radio and beat the guy up with it, and the radio fell apart, you know, we done a job on it, and like you said, the radio had a piece of the man's hair inside the radio, and the man, after the man beat the guy up with it, you know, we did him up. He used the radio to call his police headquarters up, and they sent reinforcements over there afterwards. So the radio, we worked out real good. So the reason why I love Motorola is the quality that goes inside there. And that's it there, Dick. Back to you, W2WK.
Yeah, I think Motorola is the number one company in the United States producing that kind of hardware. Well, at least they have been for a whole lot of years. Schaumburg, Illinois, I believe, is their headquarters these days. And I'd love to know a big number. So, fascinating company. They've had their ups and downs. They're going through a pretty good up period right now, from what I can tell. And they're out there buying things, buying whole companies at billions of dollars, conglomerating. And you'll be hearing more about that as time goes on. You may have heard that Motorola has made a very strong bid to buy the Symbol company, and I think Motorola has bid, has agreed to pay $3.9 billion. That's an awful lot of money by my standards for that particular purchase. So there's a better than even chance that the first quarter of next year, Symbol and Motorola will be one combined company. They both make an awful lot of handheld, very rugged, wireless. It could be a very good combination. The next person who signed in was Steve, KC2MDP. What rugged piece of equipment would you like to discuss tonight, Steve? You've got the floor.
Very good, Dick. I'd like to say good evening to you and good evening to everyone else on the net. As far as the Motorola, I do own several Sabres. I got a couple of Sabre 3s and a couple Astro Sabres. And like one of the gentlemen said, the Sabre, I think, originally sold for about $3,500, and I think the Astro was almost, you know, $4,500, and, you know, who's going to spend that kind of money for a Yaesu or an Icom for that kind of durability? Well, anyway, my question tonight concerns lithium-ion batteries. I have this VX7R, basically, I have two batteries. One battery, basically, when I bought the unit, I charged the battery. I used the VX7R, you know, for a little bit, you know, never really depleted the battery. The other battery, I'd say, I bought maybe 3 or 4 months later, and never charged it, just kept it as a spare. Now, I never really used this VX7R. It basically sat dormant for 6 months. The other day, I went to charge up the one battery. It will not take a charge at all. I mean, there's no voltage in it. I checked it with a voltometer, you know, millivolts. There's nothing in it. I even ohmed the battery out to see if there's any kind of resistance on it. I get no reading on this battery at all. Meanwhile, the other battery took a charge fine, and this is the battery that was never originally charged. I figured, let me see if it's my charger. Let me see, you know, what's going on. That battery took a charge, worked fine. Basically, I did a little bit of research on these lithium-ion batteries, and I came across a website that basically tells me that these batteries are not supposed to be discharged fully, that there's some sort of chip in there that only lets them discharge to a certain point. And if you let them drop below that certain point, that there's no way to bring them back to life. I was wondering if that's true, and if it is not, is there any way I can bring this one battery back to life? Because this battery is like an 80-something dollar battery, and I hate like heck to spend another, you know, 80-something dollars to replace this battery. Back to you.
Great point, Steve. Lithium-ion batteries are becoming more and more popular because they've got extremely high energy density. That means you can pack more joules into the same number of cubic inches or the same number of grams or pounds of battery. Second of all, they've got an extremely small discharge rate. You take, for instance, your very, very popular nickel-cadmium battery, NiCad battery. I believe they lose 20 or 30% of their charge each month just sitting on the shelf, not doing anything. and continuously discharging himself. Whereas I think a lithium-ion battery discharges itself like something like 5% in the first month and some much smaller number in the future months. So in theory, you could take a fully charged lithium-ion battery and you still have some amount of usable charge left a large number of months downrange. That's the good news. The bad news about lithium-ion batteries is that they've got some very nasty characteristics if they're overcharged. It's one of the very few, I guess it was 1995 or so, when the military found out how high the energy density of lithium batteries was. Let me drop a second. They started using them in a lot of pieces of equipment, and all of a sudden we started hearing stories about explosions. You overcharge a lithium-ion battery, and the outgassing that takes place inside is capable of doing at least two or three things that are nasty. One, exploding the case if there isn't the right kind of relief valve, and if even if there is the right kind of relief valve, the lithium-bearing materials that are inside, when exposed to air, can do some terrible things. There was at least one lawsuit where a lithium-ion battery was used on a handy-talkie, and the battery broke its case, did some terrible things, and the lithium started coming out and created a burn on the person's face alongside. The bottom line of this is that essentially every lithium battery you can get a hold of these days has a built-in protection circuit. The built-in protection circuit is there for two or three reasons. Number one, it stops you from overcharging and exploding the case. Number two, it disconnects the battery from the outside load world, the load of the outside world, if it's discharged below a particular number. I think a fully charged lithium battery is something like 3.6 volts, and I think it's something like 2.9 volts or so is the cutoff number. In other words, the internal circuitry, in theory, will not allow you to discharge the battery below that voltage. When you do discharge it below that voltage, a kind of permanent damage takes place where the battery will have decreased ampere hours from then on. If you take and lithium batteries are supposed to be, you've got a conflict of interest here. There are certain interstate laws that will not allow you to ship a fully charged battery, because if a short circuit, a battery in you from that, so it's protecting from overcharge, protecting from undervoltage, and protecting from too rigorous a discharge. The electronic circuitry and the safety valves and whatever are supposed to protect you from all these things. So you've got a conflict now when certain batteries are not allowed to be shipped charged, but yet a lithium battery should never be left in the discharge state. I think they get around that problem by putting just enough charge to bring it up to the right voltage level so that it's not internally damaging itself. However, not to fully charge it so that the total energy inside is capable of creating a smoke and flames to the outside world if an inadvertent short circuit occurs. I think that's what they're doing. As such, whenever you get a brand new lithium battery, it is my belief that the recommendation is to immediately charge it, because it may have been shipped into, let's say, the 90% discharge situation as far as where you are allowed to discharge it. So it may be only a small amount of charge left, and if you sit it on the shelf for a year and that amount drains away, you could go below the magic 2.9 volts or whatever it is that creates damage. So that battery that would not accept a charge, tell us once again, Steve, what was its previous life? Had you bought it brand new and not charged it immediately and set it on the shelf for a while? And apparently the other one you did that with did survive, but what is the history of the one that will not accept charge? KC2MDP, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Good question. How many charge cycles does my own battery have?
I pressed the wrong button and I missed the comment that somebody just made. Please repeat that comment.
I just want to ask you a very quick question. How many charge discharge cycles does a lithium ion battery have? That's all.
I've heard numbers like a few hundred. I think the total number is slightly smaller than a very, very well-treated NiCad, but I think it's a few hundred. I'm absolutely sure. Maybe Steve knows. KC2MDP, you got it, Steve.
Okay, very good, Dick. What I had read is the average amount of times to charge lithium ion is 300. Battery I'm having a problem with is the original battery that I bought the VX7R with. Basically, I bought this unit, charged it up, programmed it, played with it, used it a little bit, and basically sat it aside. It sat, probably sat for, 6 months or so. originally was going to use it for, in the trucks. That's when I bought my Motorola Saber. You know, I figured that's more durable, so that's the one I use when I'm at work. So this one basically sat here. The other day it started, let me charge it up, play with it, program a few more frequencies into it. Went to charge this battery, and I let it sit, nothing happened. I have a aftermarket charger from W&W. Let's see if there's any kind of voltage in this battery at all. You know, tried it on the 10-volt scale, the 5-volt scale, the millivolt scale, nothing. But, you know, the times 1, times 10, times 1,000, didn't get anything really out of it. And the second battery, which is an aftermarket battery, which is the one I did buy from W&W, I bought that one maybe, a couple of months after that. So let's say the original battery probably sat for maybe 6 months. The W&W battery sat for maybe 4 months, and the W&W battery was never charged. The W&W battery is the one that does now hold the charge. The original Yaesu battery is the one that I tried charging, and nothing at all happens to it. If that explains it, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've got another question for you, Steve. I think I heard you say that the original battery was left in the radio you bought it with, the VX6, I think it was. VX7R. I think you're telling me you left the battery for 6 or 7 months in the radio. Now, if that's true, I've got another guess as to what could have happened, and that is, even when the radio was turned off, most radios will draw a little bit of current out of the battery, just for the keep-alive circuit, for the memory, or whatever. So, in which case, the battery may have been very happy sitting on the shelf all by itself for 6 months, but sitting inside of a radio for 6 months with the radio slowly discharging it. That could have created this permanent damage situation where it brought the battery below its magic number, which I think is something like 2.9 volts per cell. So give me a repeat on that one, Steve. KC2MDB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, very good, Dick. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing myself, you know, that maybe the memory. But the funny thing is the memory's fine. I didn't lose memory. So I figured if this thing drained basically to complete nothing, that I would have lost the memory in the radio. But the memory's fine. Back to you.
Comment.
Yeah, I think the memory is fine because there was a separate battery in there maintaining the memory. And that second battery is only there when the first battery disconnected. See, if you're unplugging one battery and plugging in another, on the back of the radio, there is a second battery inside that's supposed to maintain the memory. And that, by the way, is usually a small dime or quarter-sized lithium battery. However, that is only the backup battery. It still does a small amount of drain from the main battery and only uses the backup when required. Some radios work that way. So even though you didn't lose memory, I still think there is a possibility the radio discharged the first battery. Comment on that?
Nope. Okay. In the VX7, the radio uses volatile memory, doesn't have a battery, W2HWW.
Dick, I got a comment.
Go ahead. Sorry about that, Howie. Go ahead, Eugene.
Yeah, since we got so many people with Sabres on the radio, I'm looking for a Saber power pack, you know, where you charge the radio inside the house. And also looking for a computer assist for it. And for the cord to program it. And also looking for the HT1000 cord. And also, things for the computer. If any, I'd like to buy one. Okay, Dick, if there's anyone listening on the frequency.
Comment that K2KUR.
Go ahead, Mel.
KC2MDP.
Mel, Steve, in that order. Go ahead, Mel.
This guy from, they rebuild battery power, and they make battery packs, from scratch if you needed them to make up anything, or if you have one with a specialized battery pack, you send it back to them, and they will rebuild it for you. And he was telling me, we're talking about batteries discharging. He says, for some reason, many of them, if you discharge it down to a very low level and then put it in a number of these charges, the inrush current of the charger, he says, blows the safety on it. So he says, then you measure it open. They have a little fuse device. But many times, he says, it presents a short for a second across the power supply that you're charging it with, and it opens up this little device. He says, then you'll measure, no matter what how you measure it, you find the pack is open, Dick. But if they open it up, they will just bring it up a little bit and then put that little fusible link back in, and the packs are good. So I guess maybe you can crack it open if you're careful enough and do it yourself, over.
Not with lifting it, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, with lifting it, you've got to be awful careful. But we got a little bit of a mystery here, because Howie believes that the VX7R has a volatile memory, that when the battery dies, you lose the memory. And I think he's talking about the main battery. Whereas Steve is telling us that on his VX7, it was the main battery that died, but he did not lose memory on his VX7R. I still think there was a backup battery inside that was maintaining the memory. That's my guess. I think you want to make a further comment, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, Steve, you don't lose memory. You don't need battery backup. They use a capacitor. They use technology in which if you take the battery off, you'll still keep the memory. Go ahead.
Yeah, but for how long can you do that? I can't believe you can do that for 6 months, Howie.
You can do it for 10 years. With the newer technology, the way the technology is, these radios will hold for a very long time. You know, using really CMOS technology, almost microamperes, really can do it for a long time.
Wow, that's impressive. KC2MDP, you got it, Steve.
Yeah, very good, Dick. So I guess basically that this battery is basket case. I should just I'll try and open it. You know, I might not play with it. It's dead. I mean, I'll try and open it and see what makes it tick. I guess basically I should just buy another battery. And just one quick comment for Eugene there about the Motorola Saver. I know W&W sells the chargers. They sell the batteries. That's where I got the batteries and the charger for mine. As far as the programming software, I've heard conflicting stories. My experience is I went to Motorola website, I signed up, I did all the paperwork, I did everything, and basically they refused to sell me the software because I'm basically not a commercial radio shop. So trying to find the software is really, really tough. Back to you.
Yeah, but we hams are crafty. We find a way, one way or the other. You did say, Steve, you're going to take apart your lithium battery. Be careful. Lithium is an extremely toxic substance. When exposed to air, it explodes on contact with water for sure. And exposing it to air, it can do some terrible things by just the moisture that's in the air. So if you're taking apart the outer plastic package and you're absolutely positively sure you're not puncturing the case of the cells themselves, maybe you're okay. I still would make sure you're doing it with gloves on, with safety glasses, in an environment where you can put it into a safe steel can if something bad starts happening, rather than having it drip into your wooden bench and start creating a fire in your house. So you're playing with some pretty fancy, volatile, toxic substances when you take apart a lithium battery. So if you think you really want to do it, Steve, be careful. Any further comments on that, Steve?
No, very good, Dick. Yeah, if I do it, I'll do it outside, you know, in the middle of the lawn or something. That way, if it bursts into flame, the worst it'll do is set a little patch of grass on fire. Lithium burns with water. I know sodium does. That's an old trick we used to do, is we used to take the old high-pressure sodium bulbs that were burnt out and take the arc tube out of them and put them in a pail of water, and then, like, drop a rock on them, and sure enough, they burst into flames. Back to you.
I wouldn't do it if I were you. You like paying for it, trying to save a battery.
I'm not sure now exactly what lithium does. I was reading an article on that subject just yesterday, but it was because the article was covering so many batteries simultaneously. I've got some of it all jumbled up in my head right now. I'm going to go back and restudy that, because more and more of us are going to be using lithium. I mean, the guys who are flying radio-controlled model airplanes these days, electric model airplanes indoors, and some of them outdoors, boy, they're using very potent lithium ion and lithium polymer batteries, and they're getting tremendous amounts of energy. You should see the flights of these things. I was at one of these shows a couple of weeks ago inside of a gymnasium in Nassau. Can't even think of the name of the town I was in now. Anyhow, so the energy density of these batteries is really great, but you've got to be awful careful with them, because I know that the chemistry inside can get you into a fair amount of trouble. If you insist on taking it apart, to do it outdoors is smart. Make sure you're wearing safety gloves and safety glasses. Don't allow your hands or eyes to be damaged. And take precautions, because it's pretty crazy stuff in there, and it ain't made to be taken apart. The next person who signed in was Jabe, KB2MAR, I think it is. What would you like to discuss? Let's hope that your subject is not quite as dangerous. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Nowhere near as dangerous. By the way, your name is Gabe, George Alpha Bravo Echo. I basically like to ask a technical net question, basically regarding coax cable cutters and strippers. Basically, who would make a very high quality type of a coax cable cutter and a stripper? Something that would cut half-inch coax. Nothing larger than half-inch. I don't want to cut like Andrew 7-8. Something that large. Just half-inch coax. 9913 type wire. Back to you.
Okay. At first I thought you were talking about hardline. Now when you said 9913, you're talking about a flexible kind of cable. And any of the machines that are made for cutting, stripping back, and properly preparing are made for a very specific brand name, model number, and whatever of cable, because you've got to get all the dimensions of the knives inside just right. So I think if 9913 is your favorite cable, I am guessing somebody makes a tool that's specifically made for preparing 9913 for putting on a connector. Now, are you going to be putting on 100 connectors, so to speak, consecutively, which makes it worthwhile? It is my guess that the tool you're talking about starts off at $50 if it exists. I could be wrong on this one. Some of the guys out there who are more familiar with this jazz, please sign in right now and tell us the right information. K2RIW on the TechNet. K2JJ. Go ahead, K2JJ. Doug, now, what kind of a tool have you bought for 9913?
Good evening, Dick, and all aboard. I use one made by X-Lite, which is quite a good tool. Has interchangeable cassettes, they call them, the actual blades for all different types of coax. They make one for RG58 size and RG8 size, etc. Buy the tool and change the little cassette knife assembly inside of it.
Okay, that's a good news. X-Lite has the one you want, and they got various cartridges you put inside for each individual cable. Who sells X-Lite? How many dollars for the main tool? How many dollars for each one of those cartridges? Back to you, Doug.
I think they're around $30 for the tool, $40, something like that. And I have the blade cassettes, I think, are around $8 or $9, something like that. But you can find them cheaper if you look on eBay. They usually have a few up there.
Okay, that's approximately the price that I thought he was going to have to pay. I own one of the special tools that are made for preparing 3/4 inch 70 ohm hardline to accept a Singer connector. And it was in that price range, $40, $50 as I remember. But I'm using about 1,000 feet of this stuff on my installation at home. So since I fell in love with that kind of hardline cable, to me it was worth it to buy the right tool to prepare it. But the average guy does, Gabe, and sorry, I should have realized, golf act, you gave it to me phonetically, and I wrote down J instead of G. The average guy, of course, with the right kind of bright light, magnifying glass, and whatever, and his sharp X-Acto knife or his Swiss Army knife, goes in there and cuts the cable manually and prepares it, tries to be careful enough that he doesn't lose too many of the strands of the outer braid on the cable. Most of us do it that way, but I'll admit that properly preparing connector cable combinations is a bit of an art form, particularly a type N connector. Properly installing a type N connector does require practice to properly prepare and install in order to get full strength and weatherproofing. We've all seen some terrible jobs. Even the more simple PL259 UHF connector is there's a whole procedure to be followed to do a good job of installing it and making a good grounding connection without burning up too much of the polyethylene insulation inside. KB2MAR, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got to get it.
Is that K2KUY?
Stand by, Gabe. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, X-Lite. I'm just looking at it now. In fact, if you get the catalog of... whose catalog is this thing? Let's see. This is Jensen Catalog. They got the Exolite Quilty Ergo Crimp crimping tool, and they got the die set for crimping all kinds of coax connectors and cutting cables of all different sizes, you name it. And you can get different die sets even for putting terminals on wire and cutting wires. The whole kit, the fact we used to use it, quite expensive. Just the basic handle cost you about $65, and then the die sets and everything are sold separate. They're different dies, and they range from $50 and up for a set of dies. But it's an excellent tool. I don't think you can destroy a tool like that. If you want to spend a little less money, there's a company called Paladin Tools, P-A-L-A-D-I-N Tools. I see it makes a similar setup like that, except their stuff looks like half the price. So it depends on how much you're going to use it. But you can't go wrong with Exolite. I've had Exolite cutters and screwdrivers and sockets and that I've used for so many years, carrying it in my attaché case. I have one of those attaché cases they put out with all the hand tools in it, the place to put your heater and a whole bunch of things. You know, that's a special laid out case for servicing in a field. And I don't think you can go wrong with Exolite, to tell you the truth, Dick. They have, if you get the catalog, you'll see the whole business for doing any kind of coax work or terminal work for any kind of wiring over.
Very fine, Mel. That Jensen catalog of yours sounds like a very handy thing. Got lots of brand names of things like this. That attaché case of yours where you've got all these Exolite tools, when that goes through the X-ray machine at an airport after 9/11, boy, they're gonna seize you and do a further inspection. You look awful suspicious to me. Well, you did anyhow, but that was a joke. When you look through the catalog and you were looking at Exolite, does Exolite have a Cadillac version and a Volkswagen version of that stripper, or do you believe the basic tool is $60 or $70, like you were saying? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, the tool called the Ergo Crimp is, let's see, single-handed operation, etc., model number EC0000, $68.40 for that tool itself, and then depending on what you want to crimp, they go from $52.60 for dies. For instance, RG8 11, 213, and 216 die cost you $52.60. And if you want to do like fiber optics and all, they have a set of dies for $65 and so on and so forth, and a whole bunch of them in between. And then there's for crimping different connectors, you know, like eyes, fades, and all that, from number 10 AWG wire to number 22 AWG wire, and etc. Strips it and press it on there. And those dies go from $59.60 to $91.65. And the life tested on this tool, the main handle, is 50,000 cycles guaranteed, and weighs 1.1 pounds, the unit, the handle, hand unit. So I know we have one. In the place we used to use it when I was working there, they had one that I used many times. It in the shop mostly to make up cables, and it is one heck of a tool, Dick. Over.
I got one further question. The basic tool, you called it an Ergo Crimp. Does that mean it's also capable of doing stripping, or is there another tool that does the stripping? Because that was Gabe's original question. Back to you, Mel.
Let's see. Ergo Crimp tool frame. The Ergo Crimp tool is designed to achieve maximum comfort and all components. No, this is strictly the crimper. They sell the stripper. It's a stripper, that a tool that they sell separately. I saw it. It's a different stripper that is sold separately. This is strictly the crimp. The tool head goes in here for crimping. The stripper, let's see. They have this stripper here. They don't show the stripper here, I don't think. Let's see, crimps. Let's see if they say anything about the stripper. No, they don't. But I know I've seen the stripper. It's a separate tool with you can set the blade on the stripper, you know, for different spacing and different depth cutting. But I don't think it fits onto this tool. I think it's a separate one. I don't see it here. Maybe in another section of this book over.
Okay, while you search that down, let me mention something else to Gabe, and that is quite often people who buy the fancy tools to do the stripping of the cable, part of their motivation is installing a whole lot of connectors, and the other side of the coin is that they're going to put on crimp connectors. There are people who love crimp connectors. When it comes to indoor service, they probably are pretty good. When it comes to outdoor service, I'm a guy that's strongly against crimp connectors being used outdoors. And there's two or three reasons I feel that. Number one, you take a UG21 type N male connector that goes on the end of, we'll say, RG214 cable. It's a pain in the neck to properly prepare the cable and properly install that connector, and the whole operation probably takes me 10 minutes. But if I do a good job, that connector will be on the end of that cable outdoors, a piece of RG9 or RG214. It'll be there for 10 or 15 years. If I did the exact same thing with a crimp connector, first of all, the crimp connector does not, in most cases, provide weatherproofing. Second of all, the way it grabs onto the shield is a long external process, which means that there's a significant length of external choke. There's more length to the connector mechanism on the outer conductor of the cable than there is on the center conductor. So my philosophy is I'm willing to spend the time so that I own that connector and cable outdoors as opposed to it owning me, where because I chose a quick installed crimp connector, I have to replace it every couple of years. Now, somebody may make a really good crimp connector made for outdoor service. I just don't know about it. I do know that when it comes to 3-millimeter connectors, SMA connectors, that are crimp type on semi-rigid cables, I've seen the company I used to work for, AIL, do a number of life cycle tests, which was done with a salt spray machine, and quite frequently they got failures on crimp connectors. We're properly soldered on 3-millimeter semi-rigid cable connectors. They essentially never got a failure when the solder job was done correctly. So sometimes it's penny-wise, pound-foolish to use these quick assembly procedures for putting connectors on the end of the cable. As you're going to be hearing more from Mel later on with his third lecture on the subject of Smith chart, there's a whole lot that goes into properly treating a transmission line so you're not creating impedance bumps to give you all kinds of troubles downrange. And when it comes to failure of a transmission line, I'm almost positive that 90-some-odd percent of the time the failure occurs at the connector, not in the middle of the cable. So back to you, Gabe, KB2 MAR. And as you finally do, Gabe, buy the right tool, spend the right money, and get the performance you like, please come back and tell us what you found, and spread the news. KB2 MAR, you got it, Gabe.
WBHHWW with some comments, Dick.
Okay, let Gabe go first, and then I'll pick up your comments, Howie. Go ahead, Gabe.
RW, KB2MAR. And QS Style guys, really appreciate it. The stuff, the excellent tool you're talking about is just what I wanted, something that'll do a lot of cutting or stripping. I think, even though he was speaking mostly of a crimping tool from Exolite, I'm pretty sure they're going to have an excellent stripper and probably the also excellent cutter also. Basically, a crimping tool, I don't think I'm going to need something that elaborate. I don't think I would want to buy those dies and all that. I don't really crimp. I got to solder and all that stuff. Crimping, I'm not too crazy, but the only thing I crimp is the indoor connectors on the coaxial for the TV set, just like you were saying before, the indoor side. But that's the only thing I crimp. Otherwise, everything is solder. Howie, go ahead.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with Exolite. And Jensen catalog's great. When I was doing stuff before I lost my sight, I used to use Exolite, had always had Exolite toolboxes. Dick, I actually agree with you. I'm noticing that companies like Cellwave and TXRX, they're using crimping on the coax assembly for the duplexes. And that doesn't sit well with me. You know, I've been told by the manufacturers, Dick, that if you use the right tool with the right amount of pressure, they say it's a better connection than a solder connection. I find that hard to believe. And I had a guy say, well, you know, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. But they say they've done testing. But You know, I just put up a couple of pieces of hardline lately, and I didn't solder it. I'm a little concerned about that. Someone did some hardline connectors, and we just used crimp-on, and they claim that you can screw on a hardline connector these days, and using the right tools from either Andrews or RFS, they claim that it's just as good as soldering. I don't know. I agree with you, Dick. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, Howie. When it comes to cables of half inch, 5/8, 3/4, 7/8, inch and a quarter, and so on, hard line connectors, 90-some-odd% of all the connectors being used out there are, I wouldn't call them crimp connectors, but they've got a real nut and bolt assembly to them, so to speak. In other words, you take a pair of wrenches, and the nut on the back of the connector operates through a threaded mechanism, and with the second wrench, you're holding on to the body of the connector, on the connector, and you're bringing one against the other. The collet mechanism is squeezing down on the cable, and there are O-rings in there. Those kind of connectors on hardline, I do not call them crimp connectors. I'll admit that when you tighten it on the end of the cable, it is a crimping-like operation, but it's a lot more than crimping. There's real O-rings, and there's real collet mechanisms, there's a real internal ferrule, and so on. And those kind of connectors properly installed are very, very reliable. They're being used by the billions every year on cable TV systems. And when it comes to a type F connector that you put on the end of either RG59 or RG6, there I've used crimp. And on internal wiring, I think they're pretty good. And there are ways of weatherproofing them if you use them outdoors. I will admit that a properly installed F connector with real good weatherproofing outdoors seems to do a pretty good job. But when it comes to type N and UHF connectors outdoors, crimp, I don't trust them. And as Howie is indicating, the most severe service indoors is a duplexing filter, an extremely well-tuned six-cavity duplexing filter. Has the capability of rejecting undesired signals by close to 130 decibels. That number rolls off the tongue real easily, but if you express it as a power ratio, the amount of signal that leaks out of that interface between connector and cable, it's 1 over a number with 13 zeros after. That's what 130 dB is. The power ratio, 113 zeros. Huge number. We're talking about a million of a billion is what we're literally talking. A thousandth of a billion is what we're talking about with 13 zeros. A billion is like 10 to the minus 9. Yeah. It's a thousandth of a billion. It's a trillion. 1 trillionth of the energy going down the cable is leaking out of the connector if you do a good job. That's what you require for your duplexing filter. Your duplexing filter has got about 6 jumper cables to it going to the 6 cavities, or the 12, I'm not sure. But in either case, every one of those you want to be extremely well shielded. The chain is no stronger than the weakest link. If one of those connectors starts leaking, you can very rapidly lose an awful lot of the performance. You paid big bucks to buy the duplexing filter. You probably, in theory, paid some moderately big bucks to get it well tuned. It's an art form to properly tune a duplexing filter. Your normal IFR and service monitor and whatever only has about 100 dB of dynamic range, and you're looking for 130 dB of dynamic range to do a full tuning procedure. So you've got to do some fancy tricks to be able to do that. And to throw that away because you've used connectors that are not up to snuff, it could be very penny-wise, pound-foolish. Somebody probably builds a very high-quality, silver-plated connector that's made with just the right consideration for dissimilar metals to properly crimp onto the end of your very fancy double braided, maybe it's a double braid plus plus foil layer type flexible cable that's going into the jumpers for your duplexing filter. There may be somebody out there that's made a connector cable combination that has the quality for that particular service. I think they're very rare, and I don't think they're popular yet. The average guy like you and me, replacing a broken connector or buying one on the surplus market, a duplexing filter, and making sure the jumpers are in good shape, whatever we get our hands on,